KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. It's been 5 years since George Floyd was murdered by a Minneapolis police officer. In this hour, we hear from a father and son about what it's like to be a black man in America.
The very people, you know, I look to protect me, discriminate against, and harm the community I hold most dear.
And vehicles generally go down in value, but find out why Tesla's Cybertrucks are depreciating more than most. Plus, a new kids' book is full of poems about Yetis and slime. It's Words with Wings and Magic Things. It's Sunday, May 25th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. When the Senate returns from the Memorial Day recess, it's to take up a huge tax cut and spending bill passed last week by the House. Some Republican senators have already expressed reservations about the legislation in its current form. House Speaker Mike Johnson hopes they don't change it too much.
I met with the Senate Republicans, all my colleagues over there, last week on Tuesday at their weekly luncheon, and I encouraged them, to do their work, of course, as we all anticipate, but to make as few modifications to this package as possible, because remembering that we've got to pass it one more time to ratify their changes in the House, and I have a very delicate balance here, a very delicate equilibrium that we've reached over a long period of time, and it's best not to meddle with it too much.
Johnson was interviewed on CNN. The bill calls for increasing military spending and reducing spending on programs that benefit lower-income Americans. The bill would also cut taxes, mostly to benefit wealthier Americans. President Trump's slashing of the federal workforce is on pause at more than 20 agencies. A federal judge has ruled that Trump must have the cooperation of Congress before undertaking a sweeping overhaul of government. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston has ordered the Trump administration to stop issuing new reorganization plans and new layoff notices for now. She wrote that with the kinds of dramatic staff reductions that were afoot, agencies would not be able to do what Congress had directed them to do. She said while the president may set policy priorities for the executive branch, he cannot initiate any large-scale reorganization without partnering with Congress, and agencies may not make changes that intentionally or negligently flout the tasks Congress has assigned them. The Trump administration has appealed her decision and has also asked the Supreme Court to intervene. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Republican lawmakers in Texas are on the verge of passing a law requiring the display of the Ten Commandments in all public school classrooms. It's expected to be challenged in court. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports.
The bill would require Texas public school classrooms to display the King James Bible version of the Ten Commandments. During debate over the measure, Democratic Representative John Bryant argued the bill discriminates against the nearly one-third of Texans who are neither Christian nor Jewish.
It's not fair, and it's not American. And this bill is not fair, and it's not American, and it's not Christian, and it's not Jewish.
The bill is scheduled for a final vote Sunday. It's expected to pass and be signed by Governor Greg Abbott. A similar law passed by Louisiana last year is on hold pending a review by the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
This is NPR News in Washington. June is traditionally celebrated around the world as LGBTQ Pride Month to commemorate the Stonewall Riots, which occurred in New York City in 1969. One event will be held at a British aquarium. Vicki Barker has more from London.
This June, as part of Pride Month, the aquarium in the university city of Bristol is opening its doors to, quote, celebrate love, life, and the beauty of being yourself. Visitors over 18 will be able to tour its premises with cocktails in hand and learn about fish that can change sex, as well as species that defy the binary. And, in its words, learn how the underwater world reflects the rich spectrum of identities within the LGBTQ+ community. The evening event will take place June 28th on International Pride Day. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
Male politicians in New Zealand have started describing their outfits on social media. The BBC's Celia Hatton explains.
New Zealand's finance minister, Nicola Willis, unveiled a national budget on Thursday. However, some in New Zealand chose to focus on what Ms. Willis was wearing as she delivered her budget speech. In a tongue-in-cheek response, the minister's male colleague said they've never been asked about their outfits and have started supplying lengthy descriptions of the origins of their clothing, from their ties to their socks.
The BBC's Celia Hatton reporting. And I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Sundays are a day when families can kick back, maybe even shoot some hoops.
Yeah, that's definitely my favorite.
I don't know if it's my favorite anymore because he's grown 4 inches in the last 6 months and he's starting to beat me.
Ryan Ross is no shorty. He stands at 6'2". He's the CEO of the Urban Leadership Foundation of Colorado. His son, Gavin Ross, is a sophomore in high school who's now 5'10" and still growing. Basketball is more than a game for them. It helps them to slow down, bond, and reflect on their lives as Black men. Today, that's especially poignant because it's been 5 years since George Floyd was murdered by a police officer in Minneapolis. His death spurred protests nationwide and promises for police reforms and diversity policies, many of which are now being rolled back. How does a Black father like Ryan Ross think about this anniversary? What is the talk like between him and Gavin? Conversations about the realities of being Black in America. I asked him first to talk to me about what he was thinking when Gavin was born 15 years ago.
You know, I had a flood of emotions, you know, just making sure that I figured out how to make sure I was good with God. And, you know, I wanted him to be safe. I wanted him to be successful. I wanted to give him the things that I didn't have. I wanted to make sure that his life was going to be different than mine's and not have to experience some of the things I experienced growing up.
Did you have a fear about living up to your expectations, or were you more, I guess, were your fears more internal or were they more external?
It was both, right? Like internally, it was, you know, measuring up to be the kind of man that I knew I could be, that I wanted to be, the kind of man that he could be proud of every day. And externally, it's the world, man. It's a challenging place for young Black men to navigate and, you know, wanting to protect him and to try to mitigate some of the experiences that I knew undoubtedly he was going to have.
How do you both feel about the police? Because that's that outside world. That's that part that's out of your control. And I want to start with Gavin.
Well, in elementary school, I was taught that they were put in place to protect us, serve us, and just make sure everyone follows the rules. You know, in a way, I even looked up to that. But as I've grown older, I've started to see that the very people, you know, I looked to protect me started to discriminate against and harm the community I hold most dear.
Was there a moment that it started to switch for you?
I remember Tamir Rice. He was around 12 years old. he was playing with a toy gun and he was shot by Cleveland police officers. That was around 2014, the year my sister was born. And it kind of just put into perspective, like, now I have to take on the responsibility of being a big brother. And just seeing this evil starting to brew in the world, it made me scared.
You were about six, so you remember that.
Yeah.
You know, we have had this conversation many times, and every time I hear him express his feelings, I am enraged. This is what I was trying to protect him from, right? 6 years old, being afraid of the police, having to think critically about your behaviors, what you wear. Do you wear a hoodie? Do you not wear a hoodie? And the fact that he was having to negotiate these kinds of thoughts, that is just super disheartening, and it's sad. And that leads me to my feelings about the police. And it's complicated, right? Because I have good friends who've made the choice to become police officers, and that's great. But, you know, the police to me is it's like the beginning of a Charles Dickens novel, right? The best of times and the worst of times, especially for black men, because when you get pulled over by the police or you engage with the police, first of all, you get that feeling in your stomach, you get that lump in your throat, like you're nervous. Every experience that every other black man has had, you are like living it in seconds because you don't know if you're going to have a good situation or you're going to have a traumatic situation that's literally going to change the trajectory of your life or kill you.
Have you had a lot of encounters with the police?
Not lately, thank goodness. But when I was younger, I was afforded an opportunity to receive a scholarship to a private Catholic school by car, 45 minutes away from my house, by bus, 3 hours, right? I play football games. You know, obviously games are at 7, they're over around 9 or 10. The bus stopped running after a certain time of the evening. And so in order to get home, you got to get a ride. And one evening, a friend of ours gave us a ride home. It was a white girl.
All the boys in that car were black boys.
Yep, all black boys from my neighborhood, right? Police officer pulls her over and, you know, you don't hear, hey, ma'am, do you know why I pulled you over? Or, hey, are you having a good evening? First thing you hear is, what are you doing? Are you okay? Are you safe? Why are these men in the car with you? We end up being pulled out of the car, sitting on the side of the road. You know, if one of us would have decided to advocate for our rights, to say that something wasn't fair, Gavin may not be alive and I may not be having this conversation with you. For me, that was the moment when I knew I just couldn't trust police officers.
Today marks the 5th anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. Gavin, you were 10 years old then. What do you remember about that?
I didn't hear about it right away. When I did, my parents told me. The main figure that stood out for me was the time. That police officer kneeled on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes. When I think about that, I just think of the immeasurable pain he was going through. At that young age, you know, my fear was solidified, and I knew I'd have to be a lot more cautious.
Gavin, you're going to be taking your test to get a driver's license soon, and you could have your own set of wheels. What have you and your dad talked about as far as what to do if you're pulled over?
A few simple rules, right? Make sure that you follow every instruction to the T, no sudden movements. Even beforehand, make sure your license and registration are in the vehicle, in a place that cannot be mistaken for anything, honestly, just so that way you can protect yourself. The main important thing that he told me was that my job is just to make it home.
Ryan, you know, I have an 11-year-old son, my baby. He's growing up will be a black man in this world. And I have a hard time even taking all this in. I know it, you know, this is not new to me, but I hate when I think about it with my son, with my baby. It makes me so mad because he doesn't deserve that. He's sweet. He's kind. Like, how does it feel to you to have to talk about this with your baby?
It kills me, but I know it has to be done, right? I think about Emmett Till all the time, full of charisma, full of personality, and boom, some people have taken his life and have beaten him. We have to teach our kids to put themselves in the best situations to be safe while not totally just not living and becoming bubble people, right? But want to make sure that they have the skills and ability to always make it home.
At this moment, there's a lot of talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion and anti-DEI policies. And Dr. Ryan Sutton, a psychologist and professor at UT Austin, says this damages the psyches of Black people.
When we have more anti-DEI policies that do not allow us to critique a system, you end up pathologizing the people who are, quote unquote, the victims of that system. It's your fault that you're acting this way. It's your fault for feeling this way. And it's not just from the outside in. People themselves might be grappling with, what's wrong with me? This is a me issue.
How is this playing out in your work right now?
You know, it's live, man. People are internalizing this and thinking that is their fault, right? From the moment Black folks were enslaved and brought to this country, the playbook was enacted. Take away reading, take away critical thinking, take away community to damage the psyche of people. We cannot allow that same playbook, those same antics to come back into this generation and poison it again.
Well, where do the both of you get that reassurance at this moment of who you are as human beings who are Black men?
You know, wholeheartedly, my entire life, my father, he's been there for me, and every single day he instills these affirmations in me. They really help me. Without those affirmations, you know, things might have been a lot different.
Ryan, talk to me about these affirmations. How did you come up with them?
Well, you know, it's just speaking life and speaking love into my son and to my daughter that just helped them keep going throughout the day and just allow them to stand on business in terms of who they are, right? And so every day when I, you know, drop them off to school, I would be like, hey, Gavin, do your best.
And have fun.
Mm-hmm. All day long.
Focus strong.
You can do
anything I put my mind to.
That's Ryan Ross and his son, Gavin Ross. Thank you both so much for being so open and speaking with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Of course.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Ukraine and Russia released hundreds more prisoners today, ending a three-day prisoner exchange. In all, 1,000 combatants and civilians were freed by both sides, the largest such exchange since Russia launched its full-scale invasion in February 2022. Health officials in Gaza say at least 14 Palestinians were killed in Israeli airstrikes last night into today. Israel had ended a ceasefire and resumed its offensive in March, vowing to destroy Hamas and seize full control of Gaza. And events are being held throughout Minneapolis today to remember George Floyd, who was murdered by a city police officer 5 years ago. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank, part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Some good and bad news for Tesla Cybertruck owners. For a year after its launch, Tesla discouraged owners from reselling their trucks by threatening lawsuits and blacklists. And Tesla wasn't accepting trade-ins. So, the good news, you're finally able to trade in your Cybertruck for another Tesla. The bad news, Tesla seems no more eager than other buyers to pay premiums for what was one of the most ballyhooed new models in recent memory. And in fact, the Cybertruck depreciates at a much higher rate than other passenger vehicles. Anna Altchek is a trending business and tech reporter at Business Insider, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You found that a Cybertruck depreciates 37 to 38% in value after just a year. Now, how does that compare to other cars?
In the realm of cars in general, Kelley Blue Book estimates that new cars depreciate at about 30% on average over the first 2 years, and they lose an added 8% to 12% each year after that. EVs on average tend to depreciate at a higher rate. So one study recently found that EVs depreciate at around 58.8% on average within a five-year period. Kelley Blue Book estimated that Rivian's R1T depreciated at about 29% the last 2 years. So there does seem to be a steeper rate with the Cybertruck compared to other similar models.
Okay. The Cybertruck, it's unconventional looking. I mean, my kids, when we're out, they'll be like, "Ew, it's a Cybertruck." And obviously, the CEO of Tesla, Elon Musk, has become a very polarizing social and political figure. Is this more about Elon Musk or is this more about the actual Cybertruck?
I think that the Cybertruck has definitely become the most controversial vehicle. And like you said, kids still really love it. A lot of owners I speak to still really love their car. They love how it drives. They love the way it looks. But in general, it's been the target of a lot of the harassment that has been coming for Tesla the last few months. In terms of the truck itself, some people have said that they think it was overpriced at the beginning. It was a bit of a status symbol. And so we're seeing now that it's not as much of that. It's had 8 recalls since it's been released. The range is less than Elon Musk promised. The question really is, was it worth that original price tag? And now it's also embroiled in politics. So I think that just adds to the storyline.
BYD, this is the Chinese EV maker. They saw more vehicle registrations in Europe than Tesla for the first time last month. You know, Americans can't buy those Chinese electric vehicles. So is there another brand that is competing with Tesla sales here in the U.S.?
The EV segment is growing in the U.S. Tesla is still the most popular EV brand. Earlier this week, you know, an executive at Cadillac was basically saying that more Tesla owners are switching to Cadillac, which was interesting. But otherwise, it's hard to tell, you know, if Tesla owners are going to different brands. I spoke with someone at Edmunds earlier this week who was basically saying that Tesla owners are still shopping for Tesla. That's what the data shows. There's not an indication that there's another competitor that's really stealing its customers.
So last week, Republicans in Congress voted to roll back EV incentives and to block California's electric vehicle mandate. We don't know if those moves will stick, but are they indicative of a general move away from EVs in the U.S. at least?
I don't know that people are moving away from EVs. I think that there definitely has been a slowdown in buying EVs. And certainly, if the regulatory environment changes, that could impact it further. I think that the used EV market, because it's thriving so much and because you can really get a good deal, that has been a place for buyers to go to. So I think it depends. I mean, as long as there are more models coming out, I think there will be more opportunity for people in the U.S. to switch over. The issue is that the price has been a bit higher and the availability hasn't always been the same as buying a gas-powered vehicle.
That's Anna Altcheck of Business Insider. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says lead poisoning in children is, quote, an extremely significant concern. So why did he fire all of the lead poisoning experts at the CDC? Here's NPR health policy correspondent Selena Simmons-Duffin.
Back in April, Secretary Kennedy fired 10,000 staff members as part of a dramatic overhaul of the Department of Health and Human Services. Among them was the entire staff of CDC's Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Program. Since then, Kennedy has waffled about whether or not cutting them was a mistake. Just a few days after the firing, Kennedy told an ABC News reporter he believed the team was being reinstated.
Personnel that should not have been cut were cut or reinstating them, and that was always the plan.
But the team was not rehired. Flash forward to mid-May. Kennedy went to Congress to testify about the HHS budget, and Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin asked him about this program again since her state needs its expertise now.
The city of Milwaukee requested assistance from the CDC to help the city respond to lead poisoning cases tied to public schools. Six schools have been closed, displacing more than 1,800 school children.
She said the Milwaukee Health Department's request for federal assistance was denied because the lead poisoning branch had been cut.
Do you intend to eliminate this branch at CDC, yes or no?
No, we do not.
Okay.
This past Tuesday, he was asked about it again in a different hearing by Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island.
As far as we can tell, staff has not yet been hired, and I see no statements reversing your decision to eliminate the program. So which is it? Do we have a
program? We are continuing to fund the program.
Kennedy went on.
My understanding is that that program is continuing. I'm very, very happy to talk to you, Senator, after this and find out exactly what the details are.
Kennedy said that phrase, the work is continuing, many times to lawmakers about programs that had been cut across HHS. But he did not clarify who would do the work or when it would restart. The when question is especially urgent for Milwaukee because schools are closed and students are displaced now. Here's what Kennedy said about that in his testimony.
We have a team in Milwaukee and we're giving laboratory support to the analytics in Milwaukee, and we're working with the health department in Milwaukee.
The Milwaukee Health Commissioner, Mike Todorides, says Kennedy is misinformed.
There is no team in Milwaukee.
He says they had one CDC staff member to come help set up a new machine in their lab.
It's separate from the formal request that we had for a small team to actually come to Milwaukee.
He says their city health department has experience remediating lead in residential homes. Now they're facing down 140 school buildings with varying levels of lead paint hazards and trying to figure out how to manage the response effectively without the help of CDC disease detectives who had been on the way.
So they were going to send that team to Milwaukee to help us with the investigation, screening, data management.
Once the staff was all fired, he says, their request for help was formally denied.
Because they didn't have any subject matter experts within the entire CDC to support the childhood lead investigation that we were doing.
In Tuesday's Senate hearing, Senator Baldwin questioned Kennedy's claims that the work is continuing.
You can't just slash funding, fire everyone, slap a slogan on a new agency, and say that work will continue. Your decision to fire staff and eliminate offices is endangering children, including thousands of children in Milwaukee.
She said it sounds like he's committed to reinstating the CDC lead program, but that it needs staff in order to function. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
Lately, it seems like there's a new rocket launching into space every few days. The world's billionaires and superpowers are vying to outdo each other. Well, a new player has entered the space race. Last month, the African Space Agency officially opened its doors in Cairo. But they're not aiming for the moon or Mars, at least not yet. Instead, the new agency wants to use space technology to make life on Earth better. To tell us more about the program, we turn to Timidayo Oniosan. He's a Nigerian space scientist, as well as the founder and director of the company Space in Africa. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So a lot of countries in Africa are dealing with extreme challenges right now, from poverty to armed conflict. How do you make the case that investing in space can make people's lives better on a practical level?
Yeah, actually, when you look at most of the problems that the continent is facing today, a lot of it can be addressed with better information and better data. And that's the sort of value that you get from space technology. So you talked about conflict, you talk about border issue, farm yield, and even industry challenges. When you look at each of these, there's an element of space technology use case in that. You know, you can monitor borders from satellite technology. Surveillance can help with armed conflict. You can monitor infrastructure. You know, we're having a lot of issues around mining in Africa today. A lot of these are what you can actually address with better information and better data.
I wanted you to kind of tell us about how the new space agency can help when it comes to that issue of information and also with like climate change and extreme weather. Like, do you have some examples?
One of the issues that Africa is facing today is that we don't have a lot of ground stations providing data for weather, environmental pollution, and environmental monitoring. And so we have to rely on satellite, because satellite provides better coverage, wider coverage. And so a lot of this data also flow to the end user. So sometimes the end users are farmers. Sometimes the end users are fishermen. Sometimes the end users are insurance companies that are providing premium for farmers or for fishermen. Through the agency now, the goal is to bring all of this fragmentation together and institutionalize some of this program in a way that, you know, when they test certain services, let's say in Ghana, they can take the same solution and expand it across the continent.
Is the African Space Agency more focused on, is it about launching satellites, or is it more about using existing satellites in a better way?
The priority of the African Space Agency is to leverage space technology to make life better for Africans. So currently, we have a handful of African countries with national space program. But as you may know, space technologies are very expensive. And so majority of the countries with even national space program, they are struggling to like finance their infrastructures and their use cases. The idea behind an African Space Agency is to bring all of these resources together to run a continent-wide space program.
Is there something in particular that you're very excited about when it comes to the future of the African space industry?
I think I'm mostly excited about the opportunity for all the African countries to work together. In the past, this has been very challenging, and you know, most countries were just developing the program in isolation. But I'm excited about the possibility of everyone pulling resources together, everyone collaborating together for the greater good of the continent.
That's Timidayo Oniosan, founder of Space in Africa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Before the Supreme Court wraps up business for the summer, there's often a last-minute flurry of rulings. But this year, it could be even busier than usual.
I've never lived through a period like this. The government is filing motions almost daily.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has been covering the court for 50 years. And later today on All Things Considered, she'll discuss the challenges of reporting on the institution that so profoundly shapes American life. To catch that conversation, tune in on your radio, phone, or smart speaker. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. In Hawaii, there's an ancient sport that involves a sled and breakneck speed. It's not as well known as surfing, but Native Hawaiian cultural practitioners are working to change that. Hawaii Public Radio's Catherine Kluwit-Paktal reports.
The tradition of He'e Holua is thousands of years old.
Okay, put them right on the line.
These sleds weren't raced on snow, but steep stone courses.
Lying down with your face 6 inches off the stones, flying down a hill.
That's cultural practitioner and educator Mahi LaPierre at a recent Holua workshop on the island of Molokai.
Some people say the Hawaiian extreme sport, so people die.
Ancient papaholua, or sleds, were up to 18 feet long and just 6 inches wide. They were raced on tracks stretching a mile from the mountains down to the ocean. The goal was distance, speed, and survival. Pohaku Stone has been researching and riding holua for more than 3 decades. He says historically, to start the ride, you'd run while carrying the papaholua and throw yourself over a wall onto the main track.
You're holding that sled that's 50 pounds or more, and you're casting it forward out in front of you as you leap over this wall.
Once you picked up speed, you'd hurtle head first down the track as fast as 80 miles an hour. Today, holua are usually ridden on steep grassy slopes or whatever hill you can find, like at the workshop. Stone says early Hawaiian legends describe volcano goddess Pele riding holua down the lava fields, and the sport honors her. Tracks were found across Hawaii. But in the 1800s, with the influence of Christian missionaries, he says holua was banned, along with other cultural practices.
Most of those slides were systematically destroyed. There was a great movement to erase that completely.
Stone has been instrumental in piecing together what we know of holua today, from written accounts, oral histories, and archaeological research. He's led an effort to rekindle the sport. Mahi LaPierre and Iliahi Du are also working towards that goal. The two of them recently led the 3-day workshop on Molokai. Participants built 7-foot-long papaholua. Du says he hopes holua will once again be commonly practiced in Hawaii.
That's what our intention is to make it normal, you know, because it's such a lost art.
At the workshop, Molokai participants from youth to elders used hand tools to sand the rough-cut native ohia hardwood.
Just feel, yeah? See, you're instantly doing something already.
After the wood is smooth as glass, its color darkens and shines with coconut oil to help the sleds glide. Then the pieces are lashed together. For LaPierre, it's a sacred process.
2 days ago, we just had wood. Now we have a vehicle to ride in the footsteps of our ancestors.
Kanoi Lani Davis hosted the workshop through her nonprofit, Ho'aka Mana. One of their goals is fostering well-being through Native Hawaiian traditions.
The health of our cultural practices and disciplines is the health of our people.
She says participants loved the event and want to get together again to ride holua. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Kluwit-Paktal on Molokai.
This is NPR News.
President Trump's tariffs have been challenging for farmers, but sheep producers are bullish. The American Sheep Industry Association says commercial activity has declined for decades because of cheaper imports from Australia and New Zealand.
Their undercutting is pretty substantially in pricing. The imports are.
How sheep farmers are responding to Trump's tariffs. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. Thank you.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Houthi rebels are claiming responsibility for a missile launched at Israel from Yemen, saying it was fired toward Ben-Gurion Airport near Tel Aviv. The Israeli military says it intercepted the missile. There were no reports of casualties. After the Memorial Day recess, the Senate is to take up a huge tax cut and spending bill passed by the House. It would spend more money on defense and less on Medicaid and other programs that benefit lower-income Americans. And the Texas House of Representatives is expected to pass a bill today that would require public schools to display the Ten Commandments in classrooms. It's expected to be challenged in court. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Sometimes an author and an illustrator get set up together, like on a blind date. That's how it happened for Matthew Burgess and Doug Salati.
We share the same agent.
Yep.
She said, you need to meet this client of mine, Doug, and you guys should work together. And we met for coffee in Brooklyn. I remember asking him, I said, Doug, what is it that you want to work on? Like, what are you interested in making? And his reply was, I want to illustrate poems.
I love poetry. I loved it when I was a kid. I think that was a way into writing for me. It was also, as an illustrator, a completely different form to experiment with and to play with. Separate, short, tight little moments.
And immediately I was like, I've got poems.
Poems about a dragon pinata, a hungry yeti, primordial slime, a terrible, horrible idea, serious questions, dancing, and magic tricks. All in their book of illustrated poems, Words with Wings and Magic Things. For our series, Picture This, Matthew Burgess and Doug Salati talk about how it all came together.
I'll read this poem called Feeling the Colors. If you're feeling day-glow green and the glare gets in your eyes, have a glass of chocolate milk and a slice of pumpkin pie. If you're feeling purple and you wish to feel it more, consider running naked on the midnight moonlit shore. If you're feeling lemon yellow while basking on the beach, make sure you have a wide-brimmed hat just within your reach. And if you're feeling lavender in your fingertips and toes, it might mean someone misses you in a realm that no one knows.
For me, with this book, the frequency of getting to have Matthew volley over a poem and then for me to generate some sketches for it and then move on to the next one and the next and the next and the next. And it became this great little dance from one to the other.
One of the ways I describe this book is Shel Silverstein meets Rumi for kids. Basically, when I was a kid, I was the youngest of five kids, and my siblings had Shel Silverstein's books on the shelf. And I remember discovering Where the Sidewalk Ends and A Light in the Attic and staring at those illustrations and reading those poems. And it really blew my mind in the best way because of the wordplay and the sense of fun. And then when I say Rumi for kids, there's also this thread throughout the book that's a little more mystical, a little quieter. For me, watching Doug create all the different animals and children and figures that appear in the book was a total joy.
Oh, it's such a huge, huge, huge cast of characters. It goes from kids to fantastic type of beasts, you know, your dragons, your yetis, to owls and every other animal. The biggest challenge, I think, of the book was, okay, we have so many worlds, we have so many characters, different tones of the poem, different songs being sung here. You know, how do we bring it all together?
So the book is divided into seven sections, which we call portals. Welcome, wonders, wild, wee, whoops and wallops, windows, and whispers and well wishes.
At some point in the process, Matthew came in with these beautiful couplets as a way to whisk you into this next grouping. And that let me play with different types of imagery in terms of how I was using the page. So a lot of the images in the book are kind of smaller spot images, you would call them, to allow for a lot of space for the poems. But these couplets let me kind of go for more of a traditional picture book image where you're using the whole spread.
I wanted to rave quickly about Doug's seven magic tricks in the book. Doug created these seven die-cut illustrations, and for people who don't know what that means, basically there's an image that has a hole in the page, and those are the pages that have the couplets. And when you look and you just turn the page, you kind of discover that there is a gap or a window, and something from the original drawing is carried over that is visible through the window as you turn the page, if you can visualize that.
Like with Wild, Matthew's text says, "The animal inside of us who longs to wander free, the sparkling specks of stardust that make up you and me." And it's the scene that I remember from my backyard of that kind of metal slide that you would stick to in the summer, a swing set with two swings with the chain link and the rubber seats. And then there's a girl at the top who's peering over a fence and looking up at the moon, and then an owl kind of floating by. And when you turn the page, the moon is the die cut, you know, so the moon is cut out, and through that moon, when you turn the page, the owl then becomes a part of the next spread, and that next spread reveals an entire kind of whirling, rushing scene, stampede of all of these animals from all over the world, and behind them is a speckling of stardust and, you know, galaxies beyond. And it's a very dramatic scene.
You know, I teach at Brooklyn College, and I also have taught in New York City public schools for almost 20 years, turning up in early elementary classrooms as Mr. Matthew, the poetry man. And college students often arrive with these ideas about poetry. These ideas include poetry is hard, poetry is about rules, poetry is stressful because when you read a poem in school, you're supposed to solve a riddle or say the most intelligent thing. And I realized that that's not really how we start out. Poetry can be fun. And when you write poems with kids, you see how immediately they get this and they understand this. Like if you read a poem aloud to kids, they start to dance in their seats. Like they start to move. It's just so immediate.
So this is Dancer. "I'm a really good dancer when no one's around. I get high with my hands and low to the ground. I'm an excellent dancer, if I say so myself. I dance until the knickknacks shake on the shelf. I let my legs get loose just below my caboose, bounce my bum to the beat, keep the rhythm with my feet." The drawings for this poem start with this kid reaching up, and then a few jaunty movements to the left, to the right, and then this complete, you know, unrealistic reverberating of his whole body.
Yeah, it reminds me that at some point when Doug was working on the drawings, I said, we're going for, what did I say?
Oh, maximum fun?
Maximum fun.
A tall order, you
right.
know? It really reminded me of that time when you're a kid where you're not worried so much about the product or the outcome or the finished thing. It's the making.
I think in a way, the process of making the book allowed both Doug and I to enter into that childhood space of making before self-consciousness sets in, before you start, as Doug said, worrying about the product, where you make for the fun of it. That's the best kind of making.
That was award-winning author Matthew Burgess and Caldecott medalist Doug Salati talking about their children's book of poetry, Words with Wings and Magic Things. For more conversations like this one, visit npr.org/picturethis. Our series is produced by Samantha Balaban and edited by Melissa Gray. What does love look like? One of the Jonas Brothers says he has some ideas.
Love has taken many forms in my life. It could be a glance. It could be someone passing by. It could be new beginnings. Love is also forgiveness. It's also acceptance. It's also sometimes it can be just a feeling of longing.
That's cool, but you're cool, but you're cool. Little heartbreaker making all the boys cry. Don't lie. Don't lie.
Joe Jonas has just released an album, Music for People Who Believe in Love.
What we are is a lie. Tell you what we are not. Not our past, our mistakes. Free at last, and the maze. Yes, in
last couple years, being in kind of my lowest place in my life, having to look myself in the mirror and realize no one's going to come save me from my mess and say, you know what, I gotta like get myself out of this funk and be kind to myself and not so hard on myself and say, okay, like, you know, you've been doing this music, luckily, gratefully been doing this for 20 some years, and then you just kind of look up and you're like, oh, I don't know if I've been looking after my well-being as much as I could. So to be a bit kinder and show myself some love so I can go and love on others.
What I thought was interesting about this album, it's like really a mix of music styles on this album. Like, did you want to reimagine what a love song could be?
Yeah, I feel like there was a lot of things that I felt like I wanted to explore musically. My father, he is a country singer. And so I was listening to old country, 90s country music, and then even alternative rock, some stuff that I became obsessed with when I moved to New York. I wanted to kind of marriage the two within this sound. And I think that's the beauty of music these days, is that, you know, we could explore and we don't have to be bound to one kind of sound.
You know, look, it's no secret that you recently, you know, went through a very public divorce, and divorce is really hard. I recently got divorced, so I know it's a hard thing. So how are you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, I have two beautiful children that I mean, being a girl dad is like my pride and joy. Co-parenting is going great. You know, I have so much love for my ex-partner, and she's an amazing mom. You know, I think we stay focused on what's best for the children, and that's what it comes down to. So I think, you know, we kind of try to put the blinders on of all the that might be out there in the world, and we focus on just being able to be the best parents to these kiddos. And my little ones, they keep me moving. You know, I think I am strong because of them, and whatever comes my way in life, I know that I can let it fall off my back. I know at my core, I do what I do for them, because if I see that smile, I'm everything's reset.
Did this album help you process some of those feelings with those low points and I mean, with breakups in general, and just kind of, because a lot of it is like you figuring out what your life's going to be. It's not what you expected. So it's like, who am I now and how do I move forward? Did this album, or are there songs on this album that are you processing that?
Absolutely. I think a big portion of this album, I was very inspired by somebody I got to work with, Feist. She was talking about how she writes a lot of times for where she wants to be or who she wants to be. Found it very inspiring, and I always kind of wrote from a place of being where I'm stuck. And so there's a lot of lyrics that I wrote that were inspired by being in a really difficult place and knowing, you know what, I'll get out of it. This is where I want to be. When I perform this song, who do I want to be? And speaking to some of my truths.
Is there a song that you think personifies that? I think about Hey Beautiful. Like, is that a song personifying like where you would like to be?
Yeah, Hey Beautiful is a song I wrote for my daughters. If I'm no longer on this, or when, I guess something we all will have in common, no longer on this earth, what is that like to me? And when I'm having questions about God and heaven and hell and all these things, like where do we go after this life? Like the never-ending question of what happens with little ones. It's like, well, I want to be around for them forever if I can, if it's up selfishly. But if I'm not, maybe I'm in the trees, maybe I'm in this song.
You started out very young with your brothers, you know, obviously the Jonas Brothers. When did you start recognizing your own identity and your potential as a solo artist?
For a long time, I did stuff with the guys, my brothers, and that was such a satisfying, rewarding feeling and also kind of comfortable. But when the band broke up for a while, there's a lot of questions about who was I going to be, and going and starting something on my own, it just kind of fell together perfectly.
Talking to you, it sounds like the crux of love, and part of what you've learned is that in order to practice love for others, you first have to be there for yourself. That's what it is coming through in this conversation with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think the real lesson for me the last couple of years is like being able to just be okay with being alone but not lonely, and having that healthy relationship with yourself. Yes, show up for you so you can show up for others. Exactly. Go see in the mirror, tell me a lie. If I'm supposed to be here, why do I cry now? Take what's left and build a bridge again. Oh, now take the steps to be my own best friend.
That's the music artist Joe Jonas. He has a new album out. It's called Music for People Who Believe in Love. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. Have a wonderful day.
Have a wonderful holiday weekend. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, who certify designers' work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance, clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
Tiger Tom kill Tiger Cat, dumb boy Santa P and Ratto. Tiger Tom kill Tiger Cat, dumb boy Santa P and Ratto. Tiger Dog kill Tiger Cat, dumb boy Coco Bay and Chato. All the young girls killing the cat, everybody asks what is that, oh? Tiger Tom kill Tiger Cat just for biting him in the back, oh. Sachong was the bowler when we lick up the Marara.